From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the rise of militant Islamic fundamentalists in the Middle East and the government crackdowns against them in Arab countries and Israel. We talk with Chris Hedges, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. Also, we meet Janita Cole, the first African-American woman president of Spelman College, the Atlanta-based college for African-American women. Cole is also the head of the Clinton Transition Team's education group. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new adventure series set in outer space. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bill Clinton met with his foreign policy team today in Little Rock as tensions grow in a number of trouble spots and as Russian President Boris Yeltsin vies for his attention. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Little Rock.
Clinton met with his team of foreign policy advisors today, including Secretary of State Designate Warren Christopher, Defense Secretary Designate Les Aspin, and National Security Advisor Designate Tony Lake. Although Clinton has vowed to focus like a laser beam on the economy, he'll face a host of foreign policy decisions when he assumes office. Clinton aide George Stephanopoulos said today's session was not aimed at deciding specific policy. He said the situations in Russia, Haiti, Somalia, and Bosnia would all be discussed. Clinton has accepted Russian President Boris Yeltsin's request for a future summit. Yeltsin said he was worried about a lull in relations with the U.S. during the transition. Although Warren Christopher has been dispatched to set up the summit, Clinton says it will not occur until the new administration and Congress are well on their way towards solving domestic problems. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Little Rock.
Israel's justice minister said today that he opposed the expulsion of 415 Palestinians from the occupied territories last month, but was given little warning before the decision was made. Justice Minister David Libay told Israeli television that he questioned the legality of the expulsions, which denied the Palestinians the right to a prior appeal. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's cabinet had said it agreed unanimously to expel the Palestinians, who were accused of ties to Muslim fundamentalist terror groups. It's been a rough week for UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali. First, protesters spat at him in Sarajevo. Then, he had to take refuge from stone-throwing demonstrators in Mogadishu. Yesterday, an Ethiopian student protest against UN involvement in a domestic issue led to at least one death and scores of injuries. But Boutros-Ghali said tonight the protests won't deter UN action. NPR's Daniel Swerdling reports.
Boutros-Ghali is in Addis Ababa, helping guide 14 Somali leaders in their efforts to plan a conference for peace and reconciliation. He told a press conference tonight that far from upsetting him, the recent protests against the UN and his own work encourage him.
When you find a manifestation against the United Nations Secretary General in Sarajevo or in Mogadishu, for me this is something positive. It means that the United Nations is playing an active role.
Despite hours of bitter wrangling today, Somali leaders in Addis Ababa finally took a tiny step toward peace when they agreed on something to let the chiefs of three different factions rotate as chairman of the negotiations. I'm Daniel Swerdling in Addis Ababa.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials lost about a point today to close at 3,307. This is NPR. Airline officials said that about 30 people were hurt today when American Airlines flight ran into severe turbulence over Central Florida. Most of the injuries were listed as minor. The plane was American Flight 1539 on its way from Miami to San Francisco. A realtors group and a consumer watchdog organization joined forces today and called on states to pass laws designed to protect consumers when they're buying a new home. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
The Consumer Federation of America and the National Association of Realtors will push for laws requiring real estate agents to disclose they represent sellers, not buyers. The joint effort of the two groups follows a recent study by the Federation concluding that current disclosure laws are inadequate. The study said many first-time home buyers mistakenly assume the agent is acting in their best interest and end up paying too much for a house. Consumer Federation Executive Director Stephen Brobeck says only 7 states have laws that protect home buyers, and the remaining states have measures that are inadequate.
The problem with the disclosure laws is that typically that disclosure is not required right up front. It is required when papers are signed, when an offer is extended, which is well into the process.
The two groups want all states to require real estate agents to disclose they represent sellers as soon as they meet the buyers. In Washington, I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
Anti-smoking activists welcomed the news today that the Environmental Protection Agency is planning to release a long-delayed report on the effects of secondhand cigarette smoke. EPA officials said the report concludes that secondhand smoke is a human carcinogen and causes about 3,000 lung cancer deaths a year in non-smokers. It also concludes that secondhand smoke increases the risk of pneumonia and bronchitis in children. Health advocates say the report, which is to be released on Thursday, could motivate state and local governments to put further restrictions on smoking in public. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Militant Islamic fundamentalists are challenging governments across the Arab world. Arab governments are cracking down against the militants. In Tunis, the interior ministers of Egypt, Algeria, and Tunisia just met to widen cooperation and exchange intelligence on the activities of Muslim fundamentalists. Last month, Israel deported over 400 Palestinians accused of being militant Muslim fundamentalists who threaten Israel's security. My guest Chris Hedges is Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He's based in Cairo. We called him earlier today at his parents' home in Syracuse, New York, where he's been visiting for the holidays. He told me you can see signs of the growing fundamentalist movement in the streets of Cairo, where more women are wearing the veil. I asked him if he thinks women are wearing it voluntarily or because they're afraid of being harassed if they don't.
I think it's both. I mean, I think in poor neighborhoods, it's clearly a fear of reprisals where the fundamentalists control your alley or your street. There's going to be a certain harassment if you don't wear the veil. But I think that I wouldn't say that it's exclusively so. Women, for instance, poor women find that this is a respectable way to dress without having to spend a lot of money on clothes. It means that when they walk through the streets of Cairo, they're not going to get hassled by guys. It's a statement of their own personal morality. And also, it's a sign of protest. Those of us in the West may look at this and see it as antiquated, but for an Arab, this is a way of sort of tweaking your nose at the powers that be, because the powers that be don't like it. And I think that's an important element of the whole Islamic movement, especially among the young. And it's why it's really taken root in universities throughout the Middle East.
King Hussein of Jordan has said that he thinks secular governments are over in the Arab world, and he sees Islamic democracy as the future, that the future lies in modernizing Islam. Is he alone in seeing it that way? Are there other leaders of the Arab world who feel the same way?
Well, he's certainly alone when compared to his neighbors in Syria or Iraq. They have no desire to modernize Islam, and both Hafez al-Assad and Saddam Hussein, along with others like Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, have been very, very rough, brutal with their fundamentalist movement. So there's been no attempt by many of these governments to build a coalition. And in Algeria, of course, under this military junta, they've really moved to wipe out any trace of Islam, not only within the government, of course, but within the street. I mean, people with beards and skull caps are picked up and questioned and given a much rougher treatment just because of their physical appearance. So I would say, number one, he's in a minority. Number two, I'm not quite sure what he means. Islam has always played an important part in the Arab world and has always been a force that has had to be reckoned with. What is modern Islam and what is, I mean, this, these are theological sort of interpretations. I'm not quite clear what he's driving at, other than I know that the king is no friend of the fundamentalists.
If Islamic militants took over Arab governments, if they succeeded in taking over the governments, how do you think the governments would be changed? What do you think life would be like under Islamic fundamentalist governments?
Well, you'd have a lot of unemployed belly dancers in Cairo, just to start. You know, there'd be a certain... These guys place a great emphasis on personal piety, at least the public face of it. You know, you'd have the nightclubs and stuff closed down. A city like Cairo would be changed dramatically, as was Tehran, which was a big sort of den of iniquity or whatever, at least in the Arab world, with strips and stuff like this. There's a certain strain of intolerance in this movement towards any group or organization or viewpoint that is not seen as Islamic. Well, they can, as in Iran, tolerate divisions and disputes within their own circle. They are completely intolerant of people, of especially secularists. Well, anybody outside of this Islamic movement. So I think we'd see that. I mean, the secular press would get wiped out. I worry that there would be a certain amount of bloodletting. There'd be a lot of revenge, which we saw in Iran after the revolution. I think we'd probably also see a fair exodus, which we also saw in Iran. And this worries the Europeans, and especially the French, of people who just, feel they have nothing left to lose by packing up and leaving the country.
In December, Israel expelled 400 people who were accused of being Islamic fundamentalists who threatened Israel's security. I wonder if you think, that although Arab countries have condemned Israel for expelling these Islamic fundamentalists, you could say that a lot of the Arab governments have done far worse in their fight against Islamic fundamentalists. Algeria moved 9,000 suspected Islamic militants to remote camps in the Sahara. Egypt jailed about 1,000 suspects in the last 6 months, and in July issued a death penalty for members of organizations deemed terrorist.
Yeah, I think that's true. Which is probably why they're not burning the midnight oil in Cairo or anywhere else to sort of get these guys out of the fix they're in. I think that, it may not be stated, but there's a certain sympathy for the Israelis in this particular instance.
Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said, just as the state of Israel was the first to recognize the Iraqi nuclear danger, thus we stand first today in the line of fire against the danger of extremist Islam. Do you think that there's any chance of Israel uniting with Arab leaders around the issue of Islamic militants?
I doubt it. I'm not sure that, for instance, the Egyptians view their problem with Islamic fundamentalists as of the same fabric, it's part of the same fabric as the Israeli problem with Islamic fundamentalists. I think there are certain parallels, but I don't know that Arab leaders would. I think they'd be very reluctant to ever admit it. And let me just add there that this has become the new Israeli line, where before the collapse of the Soviet Union, they were the bulwark of democracy and U.S. security, etc. in the Middle East. Now they're at the forefront of fighting Islamic fundamentalism. And I go to Gaza, and I go to Algiers, and I find a certain similarity. And the similarity is that the governing power in Algiers or in Gaza is discredited and unwanted. And that's the similarity. But the notion that somehow this is some kind of viral infection that they're going to help stomp out misses the whole point of why this movement exists and why it's growing.
You were just in Israel before coming to the States for the holidays. What is the debate in Israel like about the expulsion of the Islamic militants?
There isn't a lot of debate. The opinion poll, I think it was Audits, or one of the major papers ran, I think it was the day or day after of the expulsion, it was 91% of Israelis backed it. I did find, interestingly, that this was incredibly unsettling to the Israeli Arabs, the 760,000 Arabs who carry Israeli passports and live inside the Green Line, members of the State of Israel. Not full members, of course, but members of the State of Israel. And this sort of realized their worst fears, this deportation. And you've had a lot of activity by Israeli Arabs in response to the deportation, increased sort of protests in front of the Prime Minister's office. They tried to drive to the security zone with food. So I found that this was, while Israelis didn't seem to be particularly torn over whether or not they should have done this, it did seem to drive a further, if you can go any further, a wedge, certainly with the Arabs in the territories because you had increased violence, but also with the Arabs inside Israel. And that's something that the Israelis have always been very worried about, because this is an indigenous Arab population that even if they work something out with the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, they're always going to have this group within their own society.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chris Hedges, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Chris Hedges is my guest, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. How close do you get to talking to leaders of the Islamic groups, the Islamic militant groups?
Well, we talk to them all the time.
How do you arrange the meetings? Are they open to talking with you?
Well, you know, I come, you know, I'm a representative of the great Satan. That's always sort of an element in any conversation. You know, many of these people have become much more sophisticated and recognize the importance of talking to the press. So in Cairo, they'll contact us, the major news agencies. We'll meet them at a prearranged location, usually at night. They will take us in what they consider a safe taxi, i.e. a taxi driver who is a member of their group, often on a circuitous route, to meet the leaders who will speak to us. And this is fairly common. In Algeria, things are much tighter, but I was able to meet a leader of the FIS, I have no idea of what rank, on a back street, but in an idling car. I mean, the situation there now is so dangerous. So yes, we do have contact with them, but at the same time, there is a strong degree of distrust.
Do you tape conversations?
I don't usually tape conversations, and sometimes I don't even use a notebook. It depends how sensitive it is. For instance, in the meeting with the FIS leader, I just felt that he'd be too spooked if I started pulling out a notebook, and I didn't.
Does anybody ever try to get information from you on the whereabouts of the militant groups?
No, although in Egypt, of course, I mean, we're fairly certain that they monitor us pretty closely, and you know, I had my news assistant one night. He came out of my apartment. He had just been meeting with them in the afternoon, and he got into a cab, and it turns out that it was security. And they sort of grilled him and spooked him a bit. And so they monitor us, but I've never been called in and asked to, you know, turn over my date book or tell them, you know, who I met with and where, et cetera.
My guest is Chris Hedges, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. Chris, at the close of the Gulf War, you were held hostage by Iraqis. And,
wasn't held hostage.
You were captured.
Yeah.
Yeah. Captured by Iraqis. Okay. I was kind of surprised that you went back there after you were released. You went back to the Middle East. I think a lot of people would have preferred just a safer position closer to home after an ordeal like that?
Well, first of all, I never found the Gulf War to approach in terms of my own feelings of sort of insecurity, anything that I went through in El Salvador. I mean, there were moments in El Salvador in this guerrilla warfare in the early 80s when I sort of thought I wasn't going to come out of it, a particular situation.
Because of crossfire or being captured or
No, well, everything. I mean, we were, of course, held at gunpoint by the Contras, I and Tom Jelton from NPR.
Yeah.
Held in a cornfield, and I think they were really sort of figuring on the radio whether they were just going to off us or let us go. So I didn't. I found the Gulf War. There were moments, of course, that were frightening, but I didn't find it on the sort of sustained daily level of the same intensity as the war in El Salvador now 10 years ago. Why do I go back? I mean, I do this for a living. I've done it for a long time. So, I mean, this is it's what I know how to do. It's not what I'm going to do forever. I don't think anyone should. But it's, you know, I take it, I look at it as my profession. I mean, I see it as something that I do professionally, and I try and do it professionally. It's not, you know, you don't sort of, it's not a wild joyride into combat.
I guess part of what you've learned as a war correspondent is how to behave if you're captured, because you've been captured in Iraq and in Central America. Are there things you learned the hard way by doing it wrong?
If I did it that wrong, I wouldn't be here.
I guess so.
Yeah, you do learn a lot. And, you know, in Central America, for instance, finally, I just, you know, there was a Salvadoran journalist who I worked with, and he was the only person I'd go out with. Because in a very tense situation, you do have to keep your equilibrium. And, I mean, they're all sort of little techniques, you know, never raising your voice, and never sort of being nervous, and never being spooked, always speaking the language. For instance, Neil Conan, NPR and I were both picked up together in southern Iraq after the war. Neil doesn't speak Arabic, and I said, well, you know, for the next 45 minutes, it's going to be no English, because always the first encounter when we were pulled out of the seats and had the AK-47s pointed at us and shoved in the back, etc., raced across the desert are the most tense. I'm not sure they always know what they're going to do. You know, you certainly don't know what they're going to do, and you don't want to start turning to your colleague and speaking in a language they don't know. So, I mean, there are little sort of things you learn over the years that I think help you. Again, you know, it's a bit of a wild card. One can never predict how a lot of times these people are going to react, and even if you do everything right, it doesn't mean you're going to come out of it.
Now, I know you told Neil that he shouldn't look at pictures of his family while he was being held.
Right.
How did you figure out that's something that would weaken your resolve?
Well, it's not just pictures of the family. You know, you really want to concentrate on the present. You can't help but sort of anticipate or worry about what's going to happen to you, but you want to keep that to a minimum. I think it's just you don't want to make yourself any more vulnerable than you already are. By pulling out, looking at pictures of your family, it's certainly the worst part of it. I don't know that I went through a particular experience where I learned that. I just learned after a while that there are certain segments of your emotional life that, in a situation like that, you really want to block out and just try and think as analytically and as coldly as possible.
Did you have an infant when you were being?
Yeah.
Held captive?
8 months, it was.
That must have made it particularly hard.
It was very hard, but, you know, to be honest, I tried not to think about him too much. I mean, it's pretty deadly if you start to dwell on stuff like that.
No, in a situation where you're being held captive, do you try desperately to communicate to your guards that you're human and that you're important? For instance, I'm a New York Times correspondent. There's going to be a lot of angry people in America if you hurt me.
Whether you want to communicate whether you're important or not, it depends on the personality of the guard, because that could backfire. I mean, you could very much come off as sort of a swaggering, arrogant American. I'm more interested in communicating with them as a level, you know, on the same level. And, you know, I always ask them about their kids, they had a family, how long. And most of these guys had fought in the war with Iran. They were sick of the army. And, you know, a lot of them had lost brothers. You know, I mean, it's that kind of opening that kind of channel, you know, from one human being to another that I think is the most important. I think it really depends on who's holding you as to whether or not you want to start getting into how important you are, because that very much could just sort of make them flick the safety off their rifle if you're too obnoxious about it.
Right after you were released, you wrote a really eloquent article about being held captive. It was an article that was in the New York Times, a front page story. I was wondering if you started writing that article in your head while you were still being held captive.
Well, that's an interesting story. I didn't want to write that article. And I think in retrospect, I was wrong. But I very much, and this is part of the whole sort of notion of being a professional, at least trying to be a professional. You know, I had a lot of people that I worked with in Central America were killed covering the war. And a lot of us, you know, on a daily basis, many of my colleagues, you know, hold up to, with great respect, went through a lot. And they got out of it and they wrote the story. And they really didn't dwell on what they went through. So, you know, after 5 years of covering the civil wars in Central America, I had really just as a certain amount of professional pride, didn't want to bring up my own sort of personal experiences. And it was Johnny Apple, who was on vacation in Italy at the time, who called me and sort of, you know, made me do it. And his argument was, you know, we've just fought this war with Iraq. These guys have essentially been two-dimensional figures. This type of an article will help people realize that what we're talking about is human beings. We're talking about broken lives. It will give another sort of human dimension to the whole situation, and I think he was correct. But I was, in the beginning, not going to write the article at all.
But now you're glad you did?
Yeah.
Why?
I think he was right. Because I think it did do that. I think it, these were the, I was held, Neil and I were held by the Republican Guard. And this was sort of, you know, this is Saddam's unit. And these were, you know, certainly they took care of us for the week. There was a certain rapport that was built between us. These people had suffered a lot. I think a lot of them were not particularly thrilled to be driving into Kuwait. And I think if it worked, I think it certainly made the drive, the goal of the article was to make people to stop and think. And, you know, when I came back to the States after the war and saw this kind of flag waving and the kind of euphoria within the States, I was just disgusted because while I felt that the Gulf War was probably necessary, war is never something to exult in. Or, I mean, it's not like winning the Super Bowl. We're talking about immense amounts of suffering. Not only in Iraq, but to the families of the soldiers who died in the Gulf. And in that sense, it was my own small contribution to making, hopefully, people stop and realize that this this isn't a game, that this is human life, that this is tragic.
Well, Chris Hedges, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all.
Chris Hedges is Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us from his parents' home in Syracuse, New York, where he's been visiting for the holidays. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, sexism, racism, and education. We talk with Jonita Cole. She heads the Clinton Transition Team's education group. She's also the first African-American woman president of Spelman College. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Space Rangers and Star Trek Deep Space Nine, two new sci-fi series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Somalia, U.S. troops will intensify their efforts to round up heavy weapons now that more forces and more helicopters are arriving in that strife-torn nation. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Robert Oakley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Somalia, told reporters in Washington today that American troops will go after the most dangerous weapons in the countryside as well as Mogadishu. The goal, he said, is to change the balance from empowerment by weapons to empowerment by other means. Eventually, the United Nations will take over the relief and reconciliation efforts, which has caused concern among some Somalis who would prefer the United States to stay. Oakley said America will not pull out abruptly.
What we hope is to have a melding with the next phase, or the UN phase. It really will not be perceptible in terms of what's happening on the ground.
An administration official who asked not to be named said this transfer of responsibility could be underway 6 weeks from now if Somali peace talks go well. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
According to a U.S. military spokesman, a gunman in Somalia was fatally shot by a U.S. Marine sniper after military forces were caught in a gang battle. While no body was found, officials say the U.S. Marine believes that he killed the gunman. Meanwhile, a Somali driver for the Associated Press was shot to death today by a gunman in the capital's main food market during an attempted robbery. In what may have been the final foreign policy speech of his presidency, George Bush told assembled cadets at West Point today the role he sees for American military force in the New World Order. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Mr. Bush used today's speech to expand on remarks he made last month when he warned against American isolationism. His address navigated a middle course through the arguments for and against the U.S. becoming involved in foreign entanglements. On the one hand, he said the United States should not seek to be the world's policeman. However, he said,
in a world where we are the only remaining superpower, it is the role of the United States to marshal its moral and material resources to promote a democratic peace.
Mr. Bush said no rigid criteria for sending U.S. forces into combat should be established, but he spelled out a list of principles that should guide future presidents. They include using force only as a last resort, when it can be effective and short-lived, and when its potential benefits outweigh the potential costs. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
President-elect Bill Clinton and his wife have chosen Sidwell Friends in Washington as the school their daughter will attend. A spokesman says the private Quaker school was chosen in part because one requirement there is that students take part in some community service. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than a point to close at 3,307.87 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Pentagon says that Iraq's move of anti-aircraft missiles around the southern part of that nation will not stop Western allies from enforcing a no-fly ban. Spokesman Bob Hall conceded that Iraqi missiles had been moved in a region where its planes are forbidden to fly, but said that the U.S. is absolutely determined to enforce the no-fly zone, and pilots will not be put at risk. Last week, an Iraqi fighter was shot down after it flew into the forbidden zone. A ban was imposed after Iraqi warplanes attacked rebel forces, opposed to Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. In Moscow, Russia's prime minister has taken his first step to roll back radical economic changes started 1 year ago by ordering new price controls on a number of basic goods. NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
Chairman Mertin's decree came out through the state news agency TASS and included on its list most of the key staples in the Russian diet: bread, tea, sugar, salt, butter, milk, meat, and vodka. The mechanism of the price controls has not been announced and could prove difficult to enforce among the hundreds of street vendors, kiosk operators, and commercial shopkeepers who've sprung up in the years since Russia's prices were liberalized. The move comes less than a month after the Soviet-era bureaucrat replaced President Yeltsin's reformist prime minister during the Russian Congress, and it reflects the position of the powerful industrialists opposed to Yeltsin. At that time, Chernomyrdin assured that he'd follow the reform path. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
President-elect Bill Clinton will meet tomorrow in Little Rock with the leaders of the Big Three automakers and the president of the United Auto Workers Union. Later this week, Clinton is to meet with the president of Mexico about the North American Free Trade Agreement. If this agreement is ratified, it would lead to the dropping of all trade barriers between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. While the Big Three automakers support the agreement, the UAW is opposed. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Johnetta Cole, headed the Clinton Transition Team's education group. She recently handed in the group's report, but she says she's not at liberty to talk about it. Cole is the first African-American woman president of Spelman College. The college was founded in 1881 to teach formerly enslaved women to read and write. Now this college for black women is the top liberal arts college in the South, according to this year's rankings of America's best colleges by U.S. News & World Report. Spelman is the model for the Cosby Show spinoff, A Different World. Cosby donated $20 million to Spelman. Johnetta Cole has been Spelman's president since 1987. She's written a new book called Conversations, Straight Talk with America's Sister President. I asked her if an African-American women's college like Spelman is free from racism and sexism.
I think it's very difficult for us to go anywhere in our nation, and in fact anywhere in our world, and find it a place totally free of racism and of sexism. But I can say that at a place like Spelman, and I talk about this in my book, that what is so incredibly exciting is that one senses what it can be like when we manage finally to get rid of those twin evils. No, I would not say that sexism has ceased to exist at Spelman, but I'd say it's in very poor health. I would not say that racism is nowhere to be found in and around Spelman, but I'd say that it has a hard row to hoe at that institution.
What changed for you after working at colleges that were, I suppose, predominantly white and also probably...
Co-ed, yes.
Yeah, but also probably predominantly male in terms of the faculty.
All of that is true.
Is there a certain kind of energy that you had to use to work against racist and sexist tendencies at those institutions that you don't have to use now? I mean, is there a difference?
Intriguing question. Let me just say that I think energy, in fact, is released. There is something that happens when you're in a setting where you feel valued, where you feel affirmed, where you're not spending an enormous amount of your time in defense of who you are, of what your gender is capable of doing, of who your people are. Spelman women describe this to me. I mean, they feel, at the risk of using a term that's a little rhetorical, liberated. That is, they're in a setting where no one dares to question, can you do physics? After all, you're a woman. No one would look at a class in mathematics at Spelman and say, now, girls, do the best you can.
When you were a college student, you started off at Fisk, an African-American college in Tennessee. You transferred from there eventually for Oberlin, a mixed, predominantly white college up north. Mm-hmm. What did you like and what didn't you like as, you know, being a student at an African-American college?
Well, the first thing I must remind myself of is that I was 15 years old.
That is awfully young for college.
Awfully young. And as I talk to students now who are thinking about early entrance programs, and just yesterday I was, or a few days ago, speaking with a student who was interested in doing early entrance to Spelman, I said, be careful, my young sister. You know, age does help us sometimes. I think I was very young. I also know that, as I talk about in my book, that was the year that my father passed. I was incredibly close to that wonderful man. And so I think I was leaving Fisk in part out of a need to be closer to my own family. My sister was already at Oberlin. But I remember Fisk so well. I remember the extraordinary intellectual excitement of being around people like Arne Bontemps, who was a writer and the librarian, of knowing that Aaron Douglas, the great muralist and artist, was in fact a member of my faculty. I turned on intellectually at Fisk. And interestingly, I think, I turned on to African-American intellectuals.
Now, when you were going to college at Fisk, you say it introduced you to a world of African-American intellectuals on a level you'd never known before. But the college was also very bourgeois and very status conscious. Mm-hmm. What effect did that have on you?
Well, you know, I grew up in a household that I'm still trying to figure out. Maybe it's the nature of class in America, that it takes us a while to figure out exactly who we are. You know the joke that everybody in America says they're middle class. Well, I grew up in a household that was clearly not poor. I grew up in a household that had more means than most African Americans who would describe themselves as middle class, and perhaps more means even than some white Americans, material means, who would describe themselves as middle class. But race always plays with our socioeconomic background. And so although I grew up in a household that most would say was of the prominent black family of Jacksonville, I never thought of myself as rich. I certainly knew that I was not poor. What I could say about my family is that it wasn't deeply involved in a lot of material stuff. It was there. I'm very grateful that I grew up in a household where there were books and music, classical and jazz. But there wasn't a great emphasis on acquire this, wear the right kind of clothes. I experienced at Fisk some of that emphasis on things that do have to do with status. And I'm saying this not necessarily as a criticism, but as a description. And I also would say it as a way of helping us to understand how important all of that was to African Americans of that period. That is, a folk trying to establish themselves, trying to go against stereotypes, trying to wipe out images of African Americans, all of whom come of a given socioeconomic standing.
My guest is Jonetta Cole, president of Spelman College. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonetta Cole, and she's the president of Spelman College, the author of a new book called Conversations. She's also the education coordinator of the Clinton Transition Team. Your great-grandfather founded the first black insurance company in Florida, and you described it as the most prominent black family in Jacksonville. Everyone knew who you were when you were growing up. Did you grow up with a sense of responsibility to represent the family name or to represent the race?
The answer is certainly yes. I was thinking a little earlier today about a phrase that was often used, and I think I use this phrase in the book. Folk of a given generation were called race men and race women. That is, these were individuals who were representing the race, who often thought about issues that had to do with the race. And so I grew up in an environment of deep racial pride, where there was a sense that how one behaved and how one carried oneself reflected not only on you, but on an entire people.
The African-American branch of the library in Jacksonville was named after your grandfather. It was the A.L. Lewis.
My great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It was the A.L. Lewis Library. What did it feel like to take out a book from a library named after your great-grandfather, or to sit there reading that book?
a mixture of pride and real disappointment and hurt.
Disappointment
pride
and hurt?
That it was named after Fafa, as I affectionately called him. But after all, our library didn't have as many books as the downtown library, and we knew that. And in fact, when we looked inside of our books, we could sometimes still see the plates, the identification plates from the downtown library. We knew that we got the hand-me-downs. That was the nature of being black, or as one would often say, colored in Jacksonville, Florida, in that period of time.
I want to go back to the time right after the Rodney King verdict.
Mm-hmm.
What happened on your campus? Did your students go out in the streets? Did you talk to them about that?
Oh, the Rodney King situation was the most difficult, I think, for me, of all situations since I've been at Spelman. And the reason I say that is because I really did understand the outrage that our students felt. And I mean not just the women at Spelman, but at the other institutions in the Atlanta University Center. These students were, to say upset is too mild. On the other hand, I was so aware of my responsibilities as a college president, as the leader of an institution, to keep a degree of rationality and of calm. Not for the sake of calm and rationality, but because ultimately I knew that that was really in the interest of those students themselves. Following the verdict, students in the Atlanta University Center did, in fact, begin to demonstrate their concerns and their outrage. And I'm very proud of the fact that although the sentiment was deep, although the outrage was heavy, I would say that of the 10,000 students in the Atlanta University Center schools, probably no more than 100 students actually, as one would put it, took to the streets. And when I look at the if I can, the violence of that verdict, after all, we watched Rodney King being beaten on television. When I look at the violence of that verdict, and then I look at what those students did, I think in some ways they were really quite calm. They were really quite rational in their insistence on saying in some way, we are profoundly hurt. We are deeply disappointed. We thought that things had changed in our nation.
Now, I read an article that said that you decided not to either cancel exams or postpone them a few days. How closely were the exams scheduled to the verdict?
Very close. That is, following the 2 or 3 days, no more really than 2 full days in which Atlanta University Center students did demonstrate, we were immediately into the reading period and into exams. And it was a tough decision. But the reason that I made it in the way that I did was that I was able to stand up in front of Spelman students and say, my sisters, here is a perfect example of what I think life is like for all of us. We've got to do 2 and 3 important things at the same time. If you must demonstrate, do so, but please know that you also have the responsibility to study well and to do these exams. Unfortunately, life doesn't come with one task at a time.
Was there a period before you made that decision in which you thought, maybe I should postpone the exam so that...
Oh, the pressure was heavy. I mean, yeah. The sisters had organized. They had come to say, surely, Sister President, you're not going to have us go through these exams. But, you know, let me be clear in saying that decisions that are made like that are not made in isolation. I work with an exceptional senior staff, a group of vice presidents and a provost who sit and we take each other's counsel. I also talked at length with the other presidents of the Atlanta University Center institutions, and there's nothing quite like good counsel. Even if the decision is wrong, better you've made it with a lot of folk.
When you look at your students now and look at their goals, their needs, their insecurities, their problems, how do you think that compares to your needs, your insecurities, your problems, your ambitions when you were a student yourself?
I think it is a lot tougher to be a young African-American woman today than when I grew up.
Why is that? Because officially there's a lot more opportunities now, not to mention integration in the South.
Isn't that the case? But the complexity of the lives that these young women must live. I mean, take something as basic as AIDS. You know, I think it's hard to overstate what it means to be a young person, to be in a period of growth, including of sexual growth or of sexuality, and to have AIDS confront one. I think it's tougher now to be an African American because, in fact, the civil rights movement did happen, because the black liberation movement did happen, and yet racism is still here. I think the fact that the opportunities appear to be so much more available, and yet one can look at one's own life and say, but it hasn't happened yet for me, makes it even more difficult for these young folk. And certainly on the gender question, I think the fact that we have made progress, that young women feel their own strengths and possibilities, and yet our society hasn't worked out all of those kinks, and in particular, the young men with whom they interact are not yet quite sure about all of these newfounded opportunities for these young women. I have enormous respect for the young women of Spelman. I have an enormous amount of respect for the young women of our country and the young men too, because I think life is even more complicated for them than it was for my generation.
Johnetta Cole, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Johnetta Cole is the president of Spelman College and author of the new book, Conversations, Straight Talk with America's Sister President. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Robert, it's the first day of Congress.
It is the first day of Congress. Brian Naylor reports on what the new Congress did today. And we'll also be following a congressman who's new to Washington. This is a series beginning. Mr. Horn goes to Washington. He's Congressman Horn from Long Beach, California, a conservative Republican who is here to change things. And we'll see how he does. Linda Wertheimer sees him on his first day on the Hill today. Also, news of the oil spill in the Shetland Islands and of the peace talks among Somali factions in Addis Ababa, the Ethiopian capital. We'll be hearing from Daniel Zwerdling, who's there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, two new adventure series set in outer space premiere on TV. One is Space Rangers, which starts tomorrow night on CBS. The other is the syndicated series Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which carries on the famous Star Trek tradition. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
If space is the final frontier, then someone at CBS made a wrong turn. Space Rangers is supposed to appeal to kids. It's shown in the network's lead-off hour on Wednesday nights. But I can't imagine it appealing to anybody. The show is set in the year 2104, and, like many outer space stories, it's a futuristic western. The wide-open spaces are reached by spaceship, and the rangers who uphold the law include an alien and a cyborg. Linda Hunt, the only notable actor in the entire cast, plays the boss who sends them out on missions, sort of like Charlie on Charlie's Angels, only she actually gets screen time, which, as far as her career goes, may not exactly be a plus. The creators of the show say they're stressing character, but what the pilot episode stresses is the same old shoot-'em-up showdowns in a new setting.
You are in violation of territorial code. We are authorized to use deadly force if you resist arrest. You are ordered to surrender immediately.
Hey, boss, I hear something.
What?
I think it's the sound of them shaking in their boots.
These scenes get old fast, but Space Rangers will probably die young. CBS has only 6 episodes on tap, and I can't see the network ordering any more. On the other hand, Star Trek Deep Space Nine deserves to live long and prosper, and undoubtedly will. It's set in the same time frame as its Star Trek predecessor, The Next Generation, and begins with a guest appearance by Patrick Stewart, the star of that series. Now, the only way Deep Space Nine could have screwed up was to have weak actors or to launch the series with a weak episode. But the cast is strong, and so is the opening installment. Avery Brooks, who used to play the tough guy Hawk on Spencer for Hire, is the star of Deep Space Nine, and the first African-American to get the central role in a Star Trek series. As Space Station Commander Sisko, Brooks is a lot more gentle and talkative than Hawk was, and he's got a lot of neat things to talk about. And that's the key here. Even though the special effects are terrific and the co-stars are talented, the secret to this Star Trek series, as always, is in the philosophy department. When Sisko tries to explain the concept of human experience to an alien life form, he does it by explaining something else, baseball.
The rules aren't important. What's important is it's linear. Every time I throw this ball, 100 different things can happen in a game. He might swing and miss. He might hit it. The point is, you never know. You try to anticipate. Set a strategy for all the possibilities as best you can. But in the end, it comes down to throwing one pitch after another and seeing what happens. With each new consequence, the game begins to take shape.
And you have no idea what that shape is until it is completed.
That's right. In fact, the game wouldn't be worth playing if we knew what was going to happen.
You might find that a little simplistic, but for a family show on national TV, especially a fantasy show, it's nice to hear. Space Rangers has no such depth. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give it a 2. Barely. The new Star Trek series, on the other hand, earns a Deep Space 9.
Commence station log, Deep Space 9, Commander Benjamin Sisko, stardate 46388.2. At the request of the Bajoran Provisional Government, Starfleet has agreed to establish a Federation presence in this system following the withdrawal of the Cardassian occupational forces.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. We'd like to welcome the listeners of KNPR in Las Vegas, which started broadcasting Fresh Air this week. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui, with Sue Weinstein and Robbie Harris. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, guest host Marty Moscowane talks with three young drug dealers from Camden, New Jersey, about why they sell drugs, carry guns, and belong to gangs. Also, child psychologist Dr. James Garbarino discusses children who grew up in violent neighborhoods and war zones. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Stories by Tobias Wolff and Nadine Gordimer on the next Selected Shorts.
Friday at noon on